Good morning, this is First Things, brought to you by Jackson's First Presbyterian Church. The minister of the First Presbyterian Church is Dr. Ligon Duncan. Stay tuned for First Things. And now, here with First Things is Dr. Derek Thomas. Dr. Thomas.
Good morning, this is First Things, the radio ministry of First Presbyterian Church. I'm Derek Thomas on behalf of Ligon Duncan, who is away today. And we're so glad, wherever you might be, in the car or at home on the way to church, that you've dropped in to listen to First Things once again. This morning I have with me on the other end of a telephone, Dr. Mark Knoll. Good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Knoll is the Carolyn and Fred McManus Professor of Christian Thought at Wheaton College and has been at Wheaton teaching for over a quarter century. He's very well known in Christian circles, not least because many of the students, certainly of this church, have ended up at Wheaton College or have known somebody from Wheaton College. But more than that, Dr. Knoll is a prolific author. A quick search earlier this morning on Amazon.com brought back, I think, about 87 results. Now, I'm not sure that he's written 87 books. Some of those were probably duplicates, but he has written a number of titles. And I thought we'd talk with you this morning about some of the more interesting ones for our audience this morning. Some are a little more technical. But first of all, tell us a little bit about yourself and where you were born and your upbringing, and especially how you came to know the Lord.
I'm glad to do that. I was raised in a middling-sized city in Iowa, Cedar Rapids, where my parents took me to a Baptist church on the conservative side. I certainly benefited from that experience, especially from what now, looking back, I see were godly leaders in the church, both men and women, who had the real interest of human beings at heart. I did go off to college, however, with a kind of ambiguous attitude toward the Christian faith I had learned. It was not particularly intellectual. It was not particularly attuned to culture. These were things I was interested in. At college, I had the opportunity to go further in sort of studying things, understanding things. A very important event in my life was meeting the woman who would become my wife, who was from Presbyterian circles, and to us Baptist Presbyterians were a little suspicious, but I got over that, and it was through her that I began to hear about people like John Calvin and Martin Luther, and ended up actually reading a lot of Martin Luther in my early 20s. And through Luther and Calvin and some of these people who, though dead, yet speak, I was brought to understand in a new and fresh way the meaning of the Christian gospel, the message of grace in my life. I suspect that this message had been spoken around me before in my growing up years, but had not sunk in. So from there, it seemed natural to pursue historical interests related to these people, and broadening out then to some historical interest in the United States, and then eventually Canada, and eventually the UK, and eventually the whole world. So I feel really quite blessed by God to be able to teach and to read and to write about subjects that I really enjoy and that give meaning to my life.
Now, I want to ask you in a minute or two about your role as somebody who teaches and now writes a great deal about history. But before I do that, I just want to let folks know you studied at Wheaton College before you actually became a professor there.
That's correct.
And then you did PhD studies at Vanderbilt.
That's right.
In the history of Christianity.
That's right.
And I was fascinated by the fact that you grew up near Cedar Falls in Iowa, because I've just returned from there. I was there about a month ago at a conference, and was fascinated by all the agriculture and the John Deere tractors everywhere, and the flat and beautiful part of the country I'd never been in before.
Well, that's what the outsiders, I have to put it exactly as you did, flat and beautiful.
It was. I grew up on a farm, so I sort of resonated with all the John Deere tractors that I saw. Now, a teacher of history, what leads somebody to be fascinated by history in our postmodern culture? History is more and more being relegated to something that's almost entirely irrelevant, of interest maybe to some specialists, but certainly not of interest to the general person in the street. History is more or less what you want to make of it these days. So how do you approach teaching history, particularly to young Christian folk who come to Wheaton and others who come to Wheaton? Do you encounter some of that post-modernity your students?
Right. Certainly it's present in our students, and I do get out a fair bit to other places, some Christian, some not Christian, and that certainly is a main theme of our era. I think I probably don't have so much a strategy as a desire to communicate some of the elements that made historical work attractive to me, and those elements included, first of all, real interest in the personalities and problems of the past. I mentioned Martin Luther a little while ago. Martin Luther was the type of person that, love him or loathe him, you had to admit he was a complex and energetic and very interesting piece of work. You could say the same thing for some other people I've looked at historically, like the great Puritan leader in England, Oliver Cromwell, like some of the founding fathers of the United States. I've been fascinated by Thomas Jefferson, by John Witherspoon, the only clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence. I've been fascinated by people like Benjamin Franklin, whose views really are not my views, but is just a very interesting person. My circle of personal acquaintances is relatively limited, as most of us, most of our own circles of acquaintance are, and it has been for me a great privilege to read about truly extraordinary people, often in truly extraordinary circumstances. I would say, secondly, that for anyone who values the way in which words can convey reality, there is just some splendid writing on all of the major historical figures, all of the major historical problems. I think I became a historian because of a couple of books, one by a man named A.G. Dickens on the period of the English Reformation, that conveyed a lot of great information, but was so well written, it was so well put together, that I thought this was just a marvelous demonstration of communication as well as a wonderful illumination of a historical period. And then as a Christian person, I guess over the years I've come increasingly to take very seriously the affirmation in the Apostles' Creed that the Christian Church believes in the communion of saints. And of course, the communion of saints is first of all the people that it's been our privilege to worship with every Sunday. It's been people, Christian people we know in the present. But in God's economy, the communion of saints includes people that are long dead and gone. And some of these people had wonderful things to teach moderns. Some of these people had experiences that did not work out well, but that are instructive for modern purposes. And so I've counted it a real privilege to be, as it were, in the same church, broadly considered, with people like Augustine of Hippo from 400 A.D., with people like John Witherspoon, whom I've mentioned, and Martin Luther, and Jonathan Edwards in the 18th century, and George Whitefield, and John Wesley. It's been a real comfort to know that these are my fellow parishioners, as well as the forerunners in the Christian faith.
What do you say to folk who may be listening this morning, who are not great readers, who perhaps have some conscience that they ought to be more interested in history, and particularly church history, than they are? Where would you start? Or perhaps the question ought to be approached from another perspective. If a parent is trying to instill in a young teenager a love for Christian history, where would you recommend they start?
Well, I can afford to be a little bit abrasive since I'm talking to you from a huge distance, but the first place to start is to turn off the television. We live in a culture in which many good things, actually, many useful things do come to us through television and the radio and the internet. But these are media that encourage mental passivity, mental passiveness. And certainly they're fine when used in moderation, but the overuse, I think, really does deaden the brain. So you turn off the TV first, and then I think an effort needs to be found to get hold of interesting material for people in the church or people interested in Christianity. Think they might have a little bit of interest in history. I recommend a periodical that's called Christian History and Biography. It comes out four times a year. There's usually a feature, event, or personality in each issue, and the articles are intentionally written for a broad audience. They're relatively short. They don't require much technical information. They're very well illustrated, and they're fun to read because they convey information, but they convey information in a lively way.
And that is published through the auspices of Christianity Today?
That's correct. I think on the ChristianityToday.com website you can find
right.
the information. And there is actually more and more, I would say, good popular literature. The InterVarsity Press, for example, has a series of five or six books that in 80 or 90 pages take you through the life. I think they have one on St. Francis, they have one on Augustine, they have one on Martin Luther, I think they have one on the Wesleys. These are non-technical, non-threatening, not too complicated introductions, but all of them would have bibliographies that would list the longer, the deeper, the better books, the more extensive books that get into these the various subjects. I would say that in our American educational systems, we do have a problem because much of our learning is pointed toward test-taking, much of our learning is pointed toward getting a grade for a course, and I hate to say it, but oftentimes the history courses in high school are kind of passed on to the assistant football coach who really wants to be concerned about winning the game that Friday and doesn't care too much about inspiring the students. So we get the notion that history is a dull list of names and dates to memorize, and we don't grasp what a great Orthodox theologian of our day, George Florovsky, said, that history is really the encounter with living beings.
I was a teenager in the 60s, and I remember the publication. We belonged in school to a book club, and every month we would sign up for a particular book, and there was a choice of about 15 or 20 paperbacks that we could choose from, and those of us in the club would choose one. And I remember when 1066 and All That came out, which was amusing and funny, and instilled in me, from a very secular point of view, it has to be said, I wasn't a Christian at the time, an appreciation for the past, and an appreciation for the fact that we really are children who are in every possible way linked to a very definite past. Now, you've written some very solid pieces of work, and one that I've enjoyed immensely and on my second time through it now is called The Rise of Evangelicalism, The Age of Edwards, Jonathan Edwards, Whitfield and the Wesleys. And it's purported to be the first in a series of five volumes, not all of them written by yourself, I don't think.
Oh, that's correct. Yes, it is the inaugural volume in what will be, we hope, five volumes that trace the general history of evangelical movements. Evangelical is a word that is not familiar to everyone and can be interpreted differently, but we're mostly looking at the Protestant movements that grew out of the awakenings and revivals of the 18th century that were themselves an extension of the older Protestant movements of Europe and then eventually the New World. Of course, in the 20th and 21st century, evangelical-type movements are represented all around the world. These are the movements that stress the Bible as the supreme authority of God. They stress the need for a changed life, a changed heart, usually expressed as conversion, although there's some other ways of doing this. These are the movements that put a great deal of emphasis upon the cross of Christ as the key matter in all of human history and the key matter for each individual. And these are the movements that look for some kind of serious Christian action or Christian response to the call of the gospel. And although it's a messy subject in some ways, because you don't have an evangelical church the same way as you have a Roman Catholic church or even a Presbyterian church, but the evangelical movements in time and history and in the present are linked to each other, and it's not all that difficult to try to write a coherent history. So my book covers the 18th century, the 1700s, the third volume of the series by David Bebbington, who teaches at the University of Stirling in Scotland, is now out, just out. It covers the period of about 1850 to 1900, and then we'll have books on the period 1800 to 1850, and then two books on the 20th century coming into the 21st century.
Now, this is one, for our listeners this morning, this is one of the most important historical works, certainly that I've read in the last 10 years. It's a very fresh, I thought I knew the 18th century, particularly the period of the 1730s and 40s and the Great Awakening and the ministry of such men as Edwards and Whitfield and the Wesleys. I thought I knew that period pretty well. There have been a number of biographies and treatments of it, particularly recently on Edwards. And yet there was something in this that was entirely fresh. I want to commend you in that.
Well, thank you.
Now, you've also written other volumes just recently, hot off the press, and on some other occasion we'll talk about it. But not today, but you've written Is the Reformation Over? An Evangelical Assessment of Contemporary Roman Catholicism, and that's literally just hot off the press, and as I say, we'll talk about that volume at some other time. But last year, I think it was 2004, you also co-authored a work called Wonderful Words of Life, which of course reminds us of a chorus line from a hymn, and it's subtitled Hymns in American Protestant History and Theology. Now, I'm fascinated by that book because of my particular interest in hymns and hymnology. First of all, what led you to write this book?
This is a book that I helped edit and then contributed to myself, that arose out of a fairly extensive project that was headquartered here at Wheaton College. We have an Institute for the Study of American Evangelicals, whose director is Professor Edith Blumhofer, who's quite a distinguished author in her own right. And under her direction, we had a series of meetings and scholarship that was sponsored, and actually hymn festivals, on the place of hymnody in the United States and Canada, and to some extent the British Isles as well. So there's actually a number of books wending their way to the light of day coming from these meetings, and this happened to be the first one. And so in it, we were able to put together some of the work that had been done for these different projects in what we hope is a relatively coherent account of the presence of hymns in American and Canadian history, the importance of hymnody, the things that you can learn when you study hymns over time, the things that hymns communicated to their singers when they were first written and then in later periods, and then we do a little bit of discussion of the contemporary period and the changes in church music that are occurring in our day, although mostly the work is historical.
And in that reflection on the change and the obvious change that has taken place in much of evangelicalism in the last 25, 30 years or so, from classical hymnody to more contemporary Christian music and a different genre, what were some of your conclusions about that?
I think that we did, in fact, come to two, I think, primary conclusions. One is that the historical study of hymnody points out how common it is for people to regard anything new as substandard and dangerous. So we sing in Protestant churches, and actually now also in Catholic churches, hymns from the 18th century. Charles Wesley's Love Divine, All Loves Excelling, Isaac Watts' When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, and we think these are the good old traditional classic hymns. But in the 18th century, when Watts and Wesley were writing hymns like this, these were the radical, new, creative, and very dangerous seeming hymnody that actually had a real difficult time winning their way in church. The big problem then was that these were not parts of the Bible. What was sung in English churches and then American colonial churches were the Psalms paraphrased into English verse. So what today looks radical, or what today looks traditional, was when they were first written, a real radical innovation. That is, to me, a warning not to be too upset with the newness of what is present in the great changes in church music in our day. But then the other lesson I think we gain is more or less in the opposite direction. The more the older hymns are studied, and especially the older hymns that survived over time, the more profound their message appears. One of the things we were able to do for the project is to take advantage of the work of Professor Stephen Marini of Wellesley College in Massachusetts, who went through about 200, he and his associates went through about 200 main hymnals in American history from the 1730s to the 1960s, and simply tracked what were the most often reprinted hymns. And over time, the cream rises to the top, and you look at a list of these most often reprinted hymns, and you realize that you have, with the top probably 20 of them, a really strong, what should we call it, a really strong popular theology that's very effective in communicating some of the main truths of Christian faith, very well known by the people who are singing the hymns, very well integrated into their lives, and this kind of research makes us really nervous about entering into a period in American church life where people don't sing any of the older hymns.
Now, you've also written a couple of other titles, one published just 2 or 3 years ago called America's God, From Jonathan Edwards to Abraham Lincoln, a very bold title, America's God, which conjures up all kinds of questions. And then, is that related to a volume you wrote back in 1989 called Religion and American Politics, or are the two quite dissimilar?
Well, they do overlap at some point, but they're mostly dissimilar. The Religion and American Politics book was trying to describe different ways in which religious life has intersected with politics in U.S. history. The book America's God, From Jonathan Edwards to Abraham Lincoln, was more about the changes that took place in major Christian beliefs as American society itself developed. So Jonathan Edwards is a convenient person to begin with, because he was in some ways the last of the old colonial theologians. And then Abraham Lincoln's in the title because during the American Civil War, the war between the states, he actually had some very interesting and some deep theological reflections when many of the ministers, and you think I would say most of the ministers, did not. And so that's the reason why he's in the title.
And then you've also written a volume called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind. And just recently, I think, that was back in 1995, and then I think last year you also published a volume, and I'm trying to recall its title, Between Faith and Criticism, something like Evangelical Scholarship in America, or something.
Well, the book Between Faith and Criticism actually is an older book, and it may have been released in a kind of a new edition. It actually is a study of the evangelical engagement with the Bible and more or less professional biblical study. And I thought there's no harm as a historian trying to rush in where angels fear to tread and try to write about how the people who really are well trained in biblical study have done their work and how what changes marked that sort of work over the years.
Now, one more volume that I really like, and it's one of my favorites amongst the many books that you've written, and one that I actually keep fairly close at hand for all kinds of reasons, is a book that was published 5 years ago, I think, called Turning Points, Decisive Moments in the History of Christianity. And it was a kind of book that you didn't really have to read from cover to cover. You could dip into it, you could keep it by the bedside, and read a few pages at a time. It was a very, very fascinating book. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, yes, I'm glad to. It's a volume that came directly out of teaching responsibilities. For many years at Wheaton College, I was responsible for teaching a whole survey of the Christian church, starting with Christ and the Apostles, coming right up to the present. And as years went by, it became harder and harder to figure out how you could do a survey with a little bit of attention to detail and not simply drown the students in a wealth of material. That assignment then was augmented by teaching sort of introductory church history surveys in our own church and other churches. But then the stimulus that led to this particular volume actually has there's a story behind it. Wheaton College professors had been sent to help teach Christian groups in Romania from the early 1980s for many years. And I went one summer. I was going to do a little bit of church history. But under the Ceausescu communist regime, you were not allowed to bring in anything. You could bring in one copy of one Bible, and then something secular to pretend like you were reading for fun, and that was it. So how can a teacher live without his notes? And the solution was to put on a 3x5 card, 14 or 15 dates, 325, 451, 800, 15, 17, 1910, and let those be the memory jog of very significant developments in the history of Christianity. So I had, I think, 10 nights with the wonderful Romanian students. So we would do what had happened in 325, what happened in 451, what happened in 1517. And it turned out this was a good way to have, as it were, some post holes in the big expanse of the history of Christianity. You weren't covering everything by any means, but you were able to go into some significant depth in particular subject.
Dr. Noel, let me interrupt there.
Yeah.
Our time is running out,
yes,
and I don't want us to be cut off while you're still speaking. I do want to thank you so very much. We've been speaking to Dr. Mark Noel, the Carolyn and Fred McManus Professor of Christian Thought at Wheaton College. We mentioned two books, The Rise of Evangelicalism and Turning Points. Both of these are available from the Presbyterian bookstore here at the church, or I'm sure you can get them at www.amazon.com. You're listening to First Things, the radio ministry of First Presbyterian Church. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good Lord's Day.